Hi everyone, you're listening to Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. This show is all about building a hub of relevant, insightful and actionable business insights that can help drive greater performance and innovation. I've worked with several tech startups myself and know from experience that success is underpinned by a passion for continual learning and growth. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity to speak with our guests and learn from their stories. If you enjoy this podcast, you can download the free ebook featuring my personal podcast highlights from the past 2 years at www.venturi-group.com/podcast-ebook. If you're looking for more information on today's episode, just head over to the Venturi website to check out the show notes. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Mohammed Khan, CTO of Virtualization and Cloud, EMEA, at Netcracker. I suppose there's a lot of different things I am actually really interested to kind of get your take on, but I think just it might be quite nice, again, just to kind of draw perspective and look at some of the things that, you know, you've worked on. So I suppose something that I'd be interested to see with someone like yourself is, you know, the projects that you worked on earlier on in your career. And some of those outcomes that you were kind of striving for, and how much the outcomes have changed, if at all, but how much the actual technology you've used has changed.
So I've been in technology since 1996. I remember all my friends were doing, when it came to technology, they're all doing computer science. Lots of them are doing computer science, information science, et cetera, et cetera. I always wanted to look and see where the next wave was, what the next buzzword was. And I remember I looked and I thought, computers by themselves are pretty much useless. I mean, I'll be absolutely honest with you. Unless they do something or connect to something, they're pretty much useless. I remember looking at that thinking, unless I load up everything onto these machines from day one, the most I can ever do is go and buy a CD to stick into the CD-ROM and then add up new things. Great. Fantastic. What I always knew was at some point, the real value in all these is the ability to connect to things like a telephone. In the old days, telephones, great. You know, mobiles were just coming out when I first got into telecoms, you know, digital ones. I remember even then when people used to explain to me the computer can do this, can do this, can do that. I said, you know what, to be absolutely honest, it's still not as useful as the telephone. And they used to say, what do you say that for? I said, with the telephone, I can pick it up. I can ring a friend anywhere around the world. We can have a conversation. We can go through personal things, business things, whatever. And it's still more useful because I'm connecting up to somebody else or I'm connecting up to a number of somebody else's. And your computer still doesn't do that. And then so that's why I actually did a postgrad in telecoms rather than in IT. I remember people saying to me, why are you doing that for? And I remember going into the lectures and to be honest, I hadn't got a clue what half of these things were. No idea what optics was, no idea what, you know, laser diodes and all these kind of strange things were, but I managed to scrape through. I ended up in BT and my MSc project there was looking at the distribution of signaling networks across a cell, across a cell or packet-based system. The reason for that was we wanted to see how much we could distribute things. And the reason, the main driver for that was to have a lot more efficiency, agility, and scope to do new things. And this was 20 years ago. And I'm sure 20 years before that, somebody else had a similar vision, idea, one-liner, whatever it was. So I looked at early stages of what you see as cloud. Distributed computing, network operating systems, running things that will run, building things in software that can run anywhere. And we did them through what we called application programmable interfaces. And these are very simple, and I always try and explain to people in very simple terms what an API is. You had to build these, and one of my jobs when I was at BT was to build these API libraries. Now, libraries are just a collection of APIs, and APIs are very simple. They have a name, they have a description, and then they have what they call a return. So the name of the API could be, as what I wrote all those years ago, was connect to messages. So you know what it means. I'm going to connect to my messages. The description was, once you've connected to your messages, you'll be able to download, listen to, read, forward them, etc. And the feedback was, you connect to messaging API, you'll get your messages. That's it. Literally, that's what an API is. You know, and I had to write libraries of these things because one of the first pieces of work I did was looking at the distribution and distributed environments for value-added services. Anything we see as a value-added services in those days, voicemail, fax machines. I'm sure some of your listeners will think, fax machine, what the hell is one of those? It's a forerunner to an email, and also email. And you could transfer these messages. If you had a email, you could transfer it to a phone, and you could do text to speech. If you had a voicemail, you could attach it to an email, and then you could listen to it through an email browser, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I did. And that technology that I was looking at, which was the APIs, the distributed computing, and a network operating system, is pretty much what cloud is now. So I got a pretty good baptism into that work some 20 years ago. And that was purely because BT at the time in my area didn't want to be seen as a bit carrier for somebody else's services. So as you see now, you see all the OTT over-the-top players, and they run on somebody else's network. Even in those days, 20-something years ago, BT did not want to be seen as a bit carrier. And because they didn't want to see it as a bit carrier, they wanted to see what value do they have from their infrastructure, their framework, their network, their design. And one thing we realized pretty well straight away was we almost 100% knew, to an extent, the whole user journey, the user experience, the user journey, the user quality of service, etc. We knew all this. And we also knew the identity of the customer, because they, more likely than not, they used to sign up to BT. And BT used to sign up other application houses to offer services to them. But the end customer belonged to BT. And when you look at it now, that same paradigm, 20-something years later, is still the same. The BTs, the Vodafones, etc., they know almost the whole end-to-end. The Amazon Web Services, the Google, etc., they know part of that journey. The journey by which you go through your browser, you get to a website, and then you do something. That something then is collated and it's stored, and the analytics are gathered by the cloud player. They're also trying to put, on the device itself some sort of gathering tool to do the analytics. But the real person who knows the whole thing to an extent is the service provider. Is the one who actually offers the pipe, the BTs, the DTs, whoever it is. The OTT players are getting better. Don't get me wrong. They're not like they were 20 years ago, where the only bits of information you gather were in a data center. So they are getting better. And to be honest, I don't think, looking at it from the work I do, that A1 player can offer their customers everything that they would like as a one-stop shop. What they have to do is probably partner with people, offer the experience that the customer wants, segment out the market, analyze what the customer would like, and then offer it according to what they have already available. And if they don't have it available, you know, partner with somebody else, partner with lots of people. I mean, that's why things like, the Android shop and, the app store from Apple works, because it's not just theirs. It's not just their apps on there. It's everybody's. Anybody who certifies, you can put it on there. That's a better one-stop shop. What would be even better would be to take that huge database of applications, services, and then work out through analytics and algorithms to see, okay, so Andy Davis does this as a profile. Maybe this is his application profile. So they only target things which make sense to that person, not, you know, everybody. You know, if you go shopping at one of the big supermarkets, you get inundated with rubbish for the next 5 years. That's not really what I want. That will switch me off. I will actually disconnect that. I'll say, I don't need that. What do I need to know about, you know, 16 rolls of toilet paper are cheaper today compared to yesterday? I don't care, because you're not targeting me properly. But if you gather all the information, then what happens is you actually cater better for the customer. Now, is it intruding into his or her life? Only if he or him or her has implicitly said, I don't want this. Yeah, forget it. I'm not interested. But more so, you know, more often than not, we're bombarded with advertising anyway. But what would be good is if I could have a personal cloud app store, which is just mine. So when I see and I put down a profile, I like listen to music. You know, I like to know about business apps, sporting apps. Then just give me those, and then update me with the ones that you think are applicable to me, in comparison to what I have on my desktop, my phone, my tablet, etc. So the work that I did 20 years ago, to an extent, it was pretty primitive then, but this is what you see in the cloud now. I mean, when you explain to people what is the cloud, they'll say, well, I don't know. In a nutshell, it's servers, operating system, and apps, and that's it.
Right. So it's interesting, isn't it, that the outcomes and the desire for the actual outcome, it's really not different. It's just obviously the cost, the speed, security, all these things are just optimized. And that's essentially the difference, isn't it, really?
Well, when I was doing this work many years ago, when I was working with, when I was at BT, and we were working with the likes of Microsoft and, I can't remember, was it AT&T and some others, we were restricted to what we had. We didn't have an app store of, you know, even on Android, of like 500,000 to 1 million apps. You know, times that by 10 when you go into the app store for Apple. We were restricted. So what we had to do is these crude kind of partnerships by saying, you know, I mean, you're pretty good at offering apps, aren't you, or services, Mr. Microsoft. And you, Mr. Network Vendor, is good at building the infrastructure. Why don't we work together? Beyond that, there was nothing more. What you see now is, you know, it's far more agile, far more flexible, and it offers almost like a one-stop shop for what the customer needs. What the customer doesn't want to worry about is security. He or she does not want to worry about billing. He or she does not want to worry about, how you're going to move my details around. That's up to you to deal with. All I want to know is it's secure and it's updated and it's at the right price. Beyond that, I don't care.
Yeah, I just think that the kind of approach is really refreshing to hear, I suppose, from someone who's been so involved in technology. And it's incredibly simple, but I can imagine very effective at getting the outcomes that you probably have desired from the positions that you've held.
I think one of the things that I was taught when I first went into what I would call technology. Let me give you a bit of anecdotal evidence about me in technology. I joined that MSc course back in 96, or whatever it was. Do you know, I had no idea how to log onto a machine. I had no idea how to send an email. I had no idea how to use a USB stick. I had no idea how to download my my module notes. Do you know that? No idea. Not an iota. It was so bad that one of my friends, I had to ask him to help me to log into a Unix machine or a Linux machine, as you know, as it is now, with a username and password, which you can, you mean, you've got a 2-year-old who can do a username and password now. I had no idea. And I remember logging in for the first time, and I logged in 6 months after I joined the course. And he said to me, he said, you've never logged in. I went, log. I said, what is that, logged in? He said, well, you log in and you get your, you get your information. I goes, what are you on about? I haven't got a clue what you're talking about. He said, let me get this right. You spent 6 months on an MSc course on telecoms and networking, and you don't even know what logging in is. I said, no idea. What I realized from that conversation and subsequent conversations when I had it, when I had them with my mentor at BT, was try and keep everything simple. Try and explain it in a very simple way, not a simplistic way, and not, you know, defaming anybody and belittling anybody, but explain it in a way that people understand. So I have had to lecture, and I teach software engineering, and I teach people how to code. And one of the first things I always say to them, I say, do you know what a microchip is? And they'll kind of say, well, yes and no and no and yes. And I say, and they say, why do you want to know that for? I said, because at the end of the day, that piece of silicon does everything for you in a weird way. And then I explained it to them. I said, look, the one thing you have to remember is the machine does not speak English. It hasn't got a clue. What it does is it turns those English syntaxes that we write into binary, which is an on-off, on-off, one-naught, one-naught system, which in real terms to the machine is send a pulse, don't send a pulse, don't send a pulse. And it's electricity. That's what it understands. So when you write your syntaxes, that syntax relates to something in the operating system, which then relates to something in the machine code, which is the 1-0, 1-0, 1-0. And then eventually the machine will do something. That's how simple it is. If you get that process, you will understand what you are writing is not for the machine's sake, it's for your sake. Because we don't understand pulses. Can you imagine writing a program in 1-0, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0? It'll drive you crackers. I have done it. I've done it. And it drove me crackers. I spent 4 months writing machine code. It made my head spin. That's why the syntaxes are there. That's why the if, then, else, else, whatever statements are in there in the code. To help people understand it, not the machine. The machine will do exactly what the machine wants to do once it gets the pulses. And the way the silicon works, it's a conductor. I had to explain many, many moons ago to a friend of mine. I said, do you remember at school when we learnt about AND gates, NOR gates, NOT gates, if, you know, NAND gates, OR gates, NOT gates, IF gates, whatever gates. I can't remember what they were. There were umpteen of these AND gates as well, you know. I said, that's what the machine understands. You put two pulses down, an AND gate, and a pulse will come out. You put one pulse down and nothing down on one of the pulses, on one of the connectors, and if it's through a OR gate, something will come out. If you put a plus and a plus electrical pulse down a gate, which is a transistor for all intents and purposes, nothing will come out. Because it's the opposite. I said, that's what a microchip is made of. I said, it's beautiful. Once you understand that, you'll understand how the machine works. You'll understand how the code works, the operating system and everything on top of that. And I think we tend to lose ourselves in acronyms, because it's easy to lose yourself in an acronym, because when you give somebody an acronym, then you're expecting them to know this thing. I'll let you into a secret. I know people who've given out acronyms, haven't got a clue what the acronym means. Yeah, I didn't know it meant that. I thought it meant this. So what I've always tried to do from the day dot was, the way my mentor spoke to me was, if you understand it and you understand the bigger picture, laser focus it and give it to somebody who may not understand the bigger picture. But if you can explain it to them in simple terms, not simplistic terms like making them see it, feel like an idiot, they'll get it. And once they get it, they have a base on which to build. And that's why whenever I give presentations on cloud and any of this, I always say, what do you think the cloud's made of? And they'll go, oh, well, yeah, simple. Microchips made from silicon. Really thin wafers of silicon because silicon conducts under certain conditions. Each one of those wafers has a number of these pulse gates. And if you need me to explain it, I'll explain what those pulse gates are. And then you wafer them together and they become a matrix. In other words, they can go X, Y, and Z axes all over the place, right? Then you put that onto a circuit board. And that circuit board may have lots of these chips on it. And they also have transformers and they have power supply units, et cetera, et cetera. You know, AC, DC converters, the lot. And then they also have a beautiful thing called a clock. And the clock is the thing where you hear all the time, 2.4 megahertz, gigahertz, decahertz, whatever they call these things. It is designed to time when the pulses go through. And they time it as to which gates have a pulse come through. And it's magnetic, so it holds things. Hence, you get storage, which once, even if you switch off the device, it still stores it because it's magnetic. That's why a hard drive is very, very difficult to really erase once you've written to it because of it's magnetized. The only way to really do it is probably to heat it to 2,000 degrees Kelvin and watch it melt. So you build on top of that. You have the servers that are built on that technology, and then you have the operating system, which deals with the server and does the micro, you know, the machine code, etc. And then you have the applications and they're stored somewhere and you run it and that's cloud.
Yeah. Do you find that it's almost necessary now to kind of talk in these terms more frequently because we're probably in a time where we have a generation of people who are kind of technologists, but may not understand the fundamentals of what they're actually using.
Andy, you couldn't have put it better. That's the main reason why I say that. Because if you don't understand that onion ring from the silicon chip itself all the way out to, you know, the Android phone and, you know, me sending stuff on WhatsApp. If you don't understand that, it's very hard to learn, you know, the technology. You get to use the technology, you dibble and dabble with the technology, but you don't understand it. That's why you'll see a lot of people who will make it into a mystique that part between the end user and the silicon is some sort of mystic art. It's not a mystic art. It's not a mystic art. I mean, from the days when I started writing code, in comparison to now, and I was writing libraries for things like Linux, I can build you a website in half an hour. It's all drag and drop. You know, it's all frameworks. But if you explain to somebody, they'll always say to you, oh, I'm writing it in PHP, I'm writing it in XML, HTML5, and on, and Python, and all these beautiful things. Say, okay, you're using it, but do you know what it is? And I had to explain to somebody who I'm helping to code and that. So I've been working with him for about 5 months. He knew nothing about code. He's now at the point where he can write code, debug code. He knows exactly what the thing does, et cetera, et cetera. After 4 months, I spent 2 hours a week with him. And I remember saying to him, I said, why do you think? I said to him, look, you know your machine, whether it's a Mac or it's Windows. Do you know what the underlying code is that builds those windows that you look at and you use, like the browsers for Explorer or Safari, etc., or Chrome? And he went, no. I said, but you write to it though, don't you? He says, yeah, I'm just expecting it to work. I went, that's the thing though. Wouldn't it be better to understand it and then you'll understand its abilities and limitations and you could actually write more to make it better? So I had to explain to him, I said, baseline, it's Java. Baseline. This is a technology that came out something like 30 years ago and he's still using it now. Most of the stuff we see around the house, I mean, washing machines and all these things, they're C++. Nobody writes in C++ anymore. You talk to a graduate from school, unless he's real geeky like me, he won't have a clue what C++ is. Oh, yeah, it's that ancient language, a bit like hieroglyphics on the side of a pyramid.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah.
You know, because they're all into frameworks. They're all into things like, you know, oh, I've got a WordPress framework. I've got a Moodle framework. I've got an Angular framework. Somebody must have built the framework. That's where the money is. If you look at it, if you really wanted to do it, if you could add to that framework and make it unique and different and do things only you wanted it to do, that's unique. You'd be first to market. I'm not saying it's the only way to be first to market, because you could take a framework and you can make it do whatever you feel like if you know how to manipulate the open source code.
Right, right. But it's just a kind of a, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like we just take open source for granted now. There's not much of a original framework too much of anything anymore, I suppose. I think it's efficient as far as time.
Yes.
But as you stated, there's not much originality, and I wonder whether we're looking at outside of that now for the innovation. Do you see that kind of trend happening at all?
I was a bit despondent, say, 10 years ago, when I used to look at school curriculums where IT was spreadsheets, PowerPoint, documents, and a bit of database. I was thinking, that's not really IT. That's an end user using IT. However, over the last couple of months and years, I've seen a lot more emphasis on writing code, a lot more emphasis on the basic structure and the basis of software engineering, which is not the same as writing code. And then something which has really taken off, and it's very good when you get it right, but it takes a lot of practice, is when you see a lot more of these software or IT projects based on something other than the old waterfall model, where feasibility scoping, high level design, low level design, integration, test, and then you review parts of it. So when you get into the realms of running things like in Agile, people go, what is Agile? Agile is very simple. What you do is you take a big picture and you break it up into small pieces. Each one of those small pieces is an autonomous end, start, middle, and end process. However, if you take it as face value and you just look at these little, what they call sprints in Agile, you'll have no idea how to put them together. This is where the documentation and the communication comes into it to make it really quick. But what's good about it is it's continuous design and development. You can make it continuous. It will just continuously add, it will continuously evolve, et cetera, et cetera. And that process is what they now call DevOps, development and operations. I would actually say I would put marketing into there if you're going to use DevOps in an environment, because at the end of the day, marketing hold the budget and the money which they get from finance to build these things. Development and operations will bill to that marketing budget on most of the times. And what this does is, instead of these silos, what you're doing is you're building things in a collaborative motion, which is cloud. And the skills you need from that are more than the spreadsheets and the PowerPoints and what have you. You need a lot more integral skills in that. And one of the things that I always try and emphasize with everybody who works with me or I've worked with, get your hands dirty with code. Even if you don't use it on a day-to-day basis, at least you'll see how it's structured. At least you can work out how many lines of code or scripting lines can somebody write in a day, and then you can bill accordingly. Then you can work out what your budget's requirements are, and you'll also realize how many coders you may need. But if you don't understand it, then it's a black hole to you, because everything's moving in that way.
Mm. So would you go as far as saying that, like, you have to kind of, You'll need to know to some extent how to code, or at least understand it, and be able to converse about code, or otherwise you may become obsolete. Would you take it that far?
I wouldn't say you become obsolete, because there's always skills that you'll have if you've had a number of years of experience working in technology. So you might not become obsolete. What I would say is those who are coming through the food chain right now, it's pretty much a must that you should have your hands dirty on writing this stuff. And it doesn't mean that it's only people who do IT at school or colleges or universities. It's anybody, even a doctor. I would encourage any field to get your hands dirty on this thing. Shall I tell you why? Because if you had a brilliant idea in your field that could enhance technology to make it work, wouldn't it be great if you could do the prototype yourself? You could build a prototype yourself. It might not be brilliant, but at least you see the moving parts. Once you've built the prototype, then you could go and see whether or not, A, you needed funding to build the all singing, all dancing, who you'd need to bring on board to help you to build, you know, the all singing, all dancing, and then what does it do? So when you explain to somebody an idea, isn't it great when you can actually show either some sort of simulation or a proof of concept? It's brilliant. Do you know what I find one of the hardest things is people who have great ideas and they have no idea how to harness any technology to make it happen. And they spend months trying to find the right people, and some of them are complete charlatans who they come across, and they charge them an arm and a leg and they deliver nothing. And the ones who can help them are booked up from now until doomsday. And I'm thinking, if only you knew how simple it was to build a prototype. And I'll give you an example. About a year ago, a friend said to me, he said, I'm building a portal that does e-learning. And I said, sounds great. And he said, can you help me? I said, to do what? He said, can you build me the portal and can you build me a demo e-learning module? So I said to him, I said, okay, so you're going to have to help me. What is the de facto standard and which is the best application to use? So so he went away and he told me what they were, and it was X, Y, and Z and A, B, and C, and I did it and I downloaded it. And then I looked at the frameworks and I looked at how he would build the thing and that. He got me, I said, you need to get me at least an idiot's guide of how to use this application. And he did. A week later, I was not only building these things for him, I was modifying the code, I was doing if-then statements. I actually built the back-end system as well. I even started getting on to building the API so you can actually get to a module without having to go through a front end. And he said, how did you do that? I said, every application has certain things. It has a file where you build a new project. It has a delete. It has an image, an import. It has all these things. And then it has bits where you can write pseudo code, very high level code, which can do fancy things. I said, it won't take you long if you have a good understanding on how these systems and these frameworks are built. And they're built very simply. They're either built in CSS, which is the scripting thing, I tell you where you put things on a screen, the HTML5, which the machine browser understands, a bit of JavaScript, that interactive things, press this button, that happens, press that, this, that happens. Indexing language, what the hell is that? Indexing language keeps all of your files in a structure, and it only calls upon things as and when required. It's structured because the machine does not understand our unstructured, multitasking, multi-threading brain. It just understands A, B, C, D, E, and it just does that. And then when you put it all together, it's like every other file structure that you'll see on anything else, whether it's whether it's an Android app or WhatsApp or whatever it is, that's how they're built. And I said, once you understand that, you will understand what tools you'll need. You will understand the capabilities of what you've got, and you'll understand the efficiency and agility that you can add to this if it is open source. And that's it. I said, it will take you about a year. You have to be humble enough and say, okay, I'm going to start from fresh. I had to do this 3 years ago. All my coding was C++. Then when I started doing all of these you know, more fancy ones like HTML and all this. I thought, I mean, first I did think it was a mystic art. And then I found, wow, this is easy in comparison to what we did 20 years ago, where there was no frameworks. You had to physically write if, then, if. It was, I remember just coming home from work thinking, I don't even know if I've done that subroutine properly.
Right. And how do you kind of, I suppose, advise people now to get involved in that? I know there's kind of a lot of resources, but what would you kind of recommend? Any of these code academies and just go through the tutorials? Like what would you kind of advise?
I use them all when I'm helping people to get across that bridge. One of the ones I found the best is if you can start to learn to code in what they call blocks, B-L-O-C-K-S, blocks. And blocks are beautiful because what they do in blocks is that the code, you know, the complex thing is written underneath. All you do is drag and drop the blocks into a workspace. And if you've ever seen, Raspberry Pis, those really small computers, they use Scratch. Scratch is a block-based language. Did you know that that's how they teach Harvard and MIT undergraduates who've never coded to code in blocks? If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for everybody. But you'll find people who are not prepared to do that because it's belittling me. That's the best way to learn. I did it and I love it. And one of the best things I ever did, and I was so chuffed with it, I wrote my first game in blocks.
Right. And it's just blocks. And it's just blocks. Blocks coding, is it?
There are a number of websites where you can actually. They have a full tutorial and a number of modules and courses and different, you know, entry levels like beginners, intermediate, advanced, and you can write in blocks. And what they do is it's beautiful. They start you off writing simple things like turn the Android left. So you bring in the Android and you go, oh, I need a left block. And then say, turn him right. And then you go, oh, I need a right one now. And then it goes on more and more and more and more advanced. And then finally, the blocks go and you're now writing code. And I find that the hardest thing to teach somebody is not the syntaxes, like the if, the variable, the integer, the else, but the structure. When do I put a more than and less than sign? When do I put a forward slash? When I write my first expression, do I press the space bar to do the next bit? Where do I put the inverted commas? What does the inverted commas mean? You know, those are the things which most people get frightened with because they look at code and go, I would never know that I have to go something, something, space, something, something, space, you know, inverted commas, something, 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 inverted commas. Do I put a space in the inverted commas? Don't I put in the space? Trial and error, best way, trial and error. When you debug it, you'll see it. You'll say, oh, there you are. And even now, the tools that you have to help you to make sure you don't make mistakes are light years ahead of, compared to the stuff we used. It's like light years, my God. I mean, a debugging tool in my day was called your eyesight. I think it's just time and effort. If you want to give it time and a bit of effort, half an hour a day, you'll learn it. And what that means is when you come up with new ideas, you can almost build it in any environment. I have never done app development on Android, Android developer kit, but I've written my first programs because I know how the structure works. So I drop this in and that happens. And I write a bit of code and that does that. Best way to do it is time, effort, and just jump in. Jump in the deep end. Nothing's going to happen. All you do is just switch the machine off and you start again.
I think a lot of people get themselves wound up who are in technology about how to keep up with the changing environment that we're in. But is it really that changing, or is it that just if you understand the fundamentals, you can learn this other stuff really easy, or it's not actually that dissimilar?
Yeah, it's just have the confidence just to start. And then, you know, the hardest gear is always the first gear because you're getting something from from nothing, from an inertia, and you're moving it. Just go for it. I mean, the last time I wrote a mobile app was when WAP was around. Yeah, 15 years ago. But the framework for Android, once you download it and you download some of the simulator phones and devices, it's the same. It's the same. Trust me. It's actually better. I was thinking, wow, I don't have to write a single line of code here. Not one. I can drag and drop things in, make it run on the simulator. You know, the simulators are so good, they actually fire up as if you're firing up your phone.
Right. Yeah. It's, I think it's encouraging, and I think it's also refreshing and a great reminder for people, to kind of understand how things work. And I think that it's strange that you wouldn't, if you're kind of fascinated by building technology, surely you would want to understand how things work from the foundations perspective. But either way, a refreshing approach, and I also really appreciate the way you think from a customer-centric standpoint as well. And clearly the combination of the two has kept you in good stead and allowed you to have success throughout your career. So, I think we'll finish it there, Mohammed, and just thank you very much for sharing with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.